It looks like we'll be able to complete this 25th chapter in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge tonight. This is entitled The Higher and the Lower Knowledge, published originally on 15 December 1917, not revised by Sri Aurobindo, so we have it as he originally conceived it. This idea of a yoga which develops a vision and a power of consciousness that penetrates behind appearances and sees real being instead of fractured and divided being, which sees a core of delight instead of a field of indifference or suffering, which is self-luminous, self-creative. This is the knowledge that the yogin aspires to achieve, but not simply a knowledge of the essence outside of the mundane world, but a knowledge that can enter skillfully, masterfully into the world, command its forces and resources, and bring to point divinity in the flesh. So the larger aim that Sri Aurobindo envisages for the integral yoga, and indeed for the best of what a yoga of knowledge would mount, carries us beyond the fields of knowledge which we would get from our college. It asks us to indeed do what is difficult for the mind, to silence it, and to enter into that which alone is. As he began that last paragraph that we read, when the poverty of the intellect becomes apparent, it is here that yoga steps in. That which penetrates, but unifies, that which yokes together. So we pick up this paragraph. The method of yoga in knowledge must always be a turning of the eye inward. And so far as it looks upon outer things, a penetrating of the surface appearances to get at the one eternal reality within them. The lower knowledge is preoccupied with the appearances and workings. It is the first necessity of the higher, paravidya, to get away from them to the reality of which they are the appearances and the being and power of conscious existence of which they are the workings. So yet another reference to Satchit-Ananda, if we can call it anything at all. Existence, consciousness, bliss, or better still, even the existent who is conscious of his own or her own nature and thereby delighted. It does this by three movements, each necessary to the other, by each of which the others become complete: purification, concentration, identification. Purification, shaucha, shuddhi. Concentration, dharana. Identification, actually, samadhi. The object of purification is to make the whole mental being a clear mirror in which the divine reality can be reflected, a clear vessel and an unobstructing channel into which the divine presence and through which the divine influence can be poured, a subtilized stuff which the divine nature can take possession of, new shape, and use to divine issues. So the idea of purification, of course, Sri Aurobindo has written about earlier and indeed about concentration, and indeed about the nature of realization. But he brings it back here because it's absolutely relevant to this subject of what is a higher knowledge. He is using language that we're familiar with. He's referencing Sankhyan terminology, the dualistic scheme, Purusha, the silent witness, conscious being, Prakriti, the active phenomenal nature. But for Sri Aurobindo, there is no gulf of division. There is a kind of Vedantic Sankhya that Sri Aurobindo espouses quietly in these chapters. But still, he uses language which is reminiscent of it. The idea of that which reflects reality. That's interesting, no? A reflection. Latin, reflectere, to bend back. So you see a mirror, that which goes out turns around and comes back. Prakriti reflects the reality of Purusha, but bending back comes to take itself as conscious. Or is it that Purusha makes an error and takes itself as conscious in Prakriti? Ah, now we have a dialogue. In Sanskrit, probably pratibimba is the best equivalent, which means turn back. As when you're looking at an image in a mirror, or as you look into the quiet waters of a lake and you see your own reflection. But this idea that there is some subtle confusion between that which is the essence and that which is the appearance, and which leads to the whole play of what we would call the triple world of ignorance, and wherein we become enmeshed and climb through gaining access to the lower knowledge to eventually arrive at the heights of paravidya. So let's read that sentence again. The object of purification is to make the whole mental being a clear mirror in which the divine reality can be reflected, a clear vessel and an unobstructing channel into which the divine presence and through which the divine influence can be poured, a subtilized stuff which the divine nature can take possession of, new shape, and use to divine issues. So when there is no more confusion, but instead clarity of sight, and the Purusha is not commingled with, identified with, but remains sovereign of and witness of the nature, then something else is possible in the higher play. For the mental being at present reflects only the confusions created by the mental and physical view of the world, is a channel only for the disorders of the ignorant lower nature, and full of obstructions and impurities which prevent the higher from acting. Therefore, the whole shape of our being is deformed and imperfect, indocile to the highest influences, and turned in its action to ignorant and inferior utilities. So the whole of knowledge is at question. Indocile, by the way, again, originally from the Latin, docere, to teach. And then, in French, docile. So, to be indocile is not disposed to be instructed. I don't want to be taught. I don't want to learn. This is the refusal of ignorance to be enlightened, in other words. It reflects even the world falsely. It is incapable of reflecting the divine. Concentration is necessary. First, to turn the whole will and mind from the discursive divagation natural to them, following a dispersed movement of the thoughts, running after many branching desires, led away in the track of the senses and the outward mental response to phenomena. We have to fix the will and the thought on the eternal and real behind all, and this demands an immense effort, a one-pointed concentration. So concentration, tapasya, effortful focus, dharana, that which does not move, which gathers and compresses. One-pointed concentration into that which becomes ekagrata. Yoga Sutras, this is, would be in the third chapter, verses 11 and 12. Secondly, it is necessary in order to break down the veil which is erected by our ordinary mentality between ourselves and the truth. For outer knowledge can be picked up by the way, by ordinary attention and reception, but the inner, hidden, and higher truth can only be seized by an absolute concentration of the mind on its object, an absolute concentration of the will to attain it, and once attained, to hold it habitually and securely unite oneself with it. So this refers to the meditative process wherein you fix your consciousness, typically on a mantra or your Ishta Devata, and allow nothing to break the connection. First, the connection of sight, of deliberate, focused concentration. Slowly, the gulf between the two begins to disappear. Perhaps the object disappears, only the subject is left. Perhaps the subject disappears, only the object is left. Or the object becomes elusive and moves about, becomes difficult to find. But then there is a marriage of subject and object, and penetration and subject and object become one. This is breaking down the veil, as Sri Aurobindo calls it here. An absolute concentration of the mind, to hold it habitually, which suggests that for many, the penetration into that object, the erasure of the distinction between self and object, between the apparent and the real, is first recorded as an experience. But the experience fades and one finds oneself back in the old situation, but aspires anew, regains the experience, regains it again, sustains it, and eventually the experience becomes permanent. And there is no loss of the awareness of that. The identity between subject and object is secured. Four, identification is the condition of complete knowledge and possession. Knowledge, to know, and then to possess, which confers mastery, perfection, siddhi. It is the intense result of a habitual purified reflecting of the reality and an entire concentration on it. And it is necessary in order to break down entirely that division and separation of ourselves from the divine being and the eternal reality, which is the normal condition of our unregenerated, ignorant mentality. None of these things can be done by the methods of the lower knowledge. No, this is an inner psychological discipline. It is true that here also they have a preparing action, but up to a certain point and to a certain degree of intensity only, and it is where their action ceases that the action of yoga takes up our growth into the divine and finds the means to complete it. All pursuit of knowledge, if not vitiated by a too earthward tendency, tends to refine, to subtilize, to purify the being. In proportion as we become more mental, we attain to a subtler action of our whole nature, which becomes more apt to reflect and receive higher thoughts, a purer will, a less physical truth, more inward influences. The power of ethical knowledge and the ethical habit of thought and will to purify is obvious. Philosophy not only purifies the reason and predisposes it to the contact of the universal and the infinite, but tends to stabilize the nature and create the tranquility of the sage. And tranquility is a sign of increasing self-mastery and purity. So the more one becomes mental, the higher one ranges on the scale. One is closing in on true knowledge. The preoccupation with universal beauty, even in its aesthetic forms, has an intense power for refining and subtilizing the nature. And at its highest, it is a great force for purification. Even the scientific habit of mind and the disinterested preoccupation with cosmic law and truth not only refine the reasoning and observing faculty, but have, when not counteracted by other tendencies, a steadying, elevating, and purifying influence on the mind and moral nature, which has not been sufficiently noticed. So he's gone tripping through the fields, the higher branches of our knowledge, ethics, metaphysics, aesthetics, physics itself. The concentration of the mind and the training of the will towards the reception of the truth and living in the truth is also an evident result, a perpetual necessity of these pursuits. And at the end, or in their highest intensities, they may and do lead first to an intellectual, then to a reflective perception of the divine reality, which may culminate in a sort of preliminary identification with it. But all this cannot go beyond a certain point. The systematic purification of the whole being for an integral reflection and taking in of the divine reality can only be done by the special methods of yoga. And we might remember here that Sri Aurobindo is working in the backdrop of Swami Vivekananda's studies of Jnana Yoga, in which he has laid his hands upon the old aphorisms of Patanjali, the Yoga Sutras. And if we look first at the yamas, the restraints, with which we're supposed to bind ourselves and govern our own minds and vitalities, we would see that there's ahimsa, that we would first not injure. Satya, we would speak only truth, to cultivate the being to be in alignment with what is real. Because remember, truth comes out of reality. First there is sat, and then there is satya. So learning to speak, to think only the truth, cultivates the being to be pacific, non-harmful, and truthful. And then asteya, not grasping. Then brahmacharya, to follow the path that leads to Brahman. Let's leave it at that. And to govern one's passions along the way. And then aparigraha, not to grab at things. to have a sense of release, of a sense of ease. Well, as you're cultivating and controlling yourself personally, you then have to open your eyes to the larger world and take up the niyamas, because they teach you how to deal with others. So you learn shaucha, you learn to purify yourself, you learn santosha, how to be contented, you learn tapas, how to work hard, you learn swadhyaya, how to study yourself. Yeah, not simply good books, not simply spiritual literature, but to take what you read and apply it to yourself, to look within, to gaze within, to do that thing that the Katha Upanishad says few do. Then, to become enamorated of Ishvara, the divine, to see that omnipresent being in all things, but also as a transcendent. Finally, pranidhana. So these are in Yoga Sutra chapter 2, verse 30, and Yoga Sutra chapter 2, verse 32. And of course, the whole thing is predicated on that. You do these before you begin to practice. Then you learn how to sit, how to become stable. What is it to be stable in the truth? That's the real question. Not to sit still physically, but what is an asana? To be in the divine consciousness and not to move. Pranayama, to govern the flow of your life force. To be able to see the thoughts, the experiences, all things, and yet to withdraw attention from them, to concentrate, to then meditate deeply upon this concentration that brings you and subject and object into oneness. And finally, that experience rules all. When you've had that experience and you live in oneness with the only thing that is, are you stuck there in an otherwhere? May you not descend and bring that light effulgently into all experiences and all circumstances here? Yes, you may. So Sri Aurobindo continues, it's absolute concentration has to take the place of the dispersed concentrations of the lower knowledge. Oh, this has to be the thing that we love to do. To dwell always in the divine consciousness. The vague and ineffective identification, which is all the lower knowledge can bring, has to be replaced by the complete, intimate, imperative, and living union which yoga brings. The closing of that gulf. Nevertheless, yoga does not, either in its path or in its attainment, exclude and throw away the forms of the lower knowledge, except when it takes the shape of an extreme asceticism or a mysticism altogether intolerant of this other divine mystery of the world existence. Yes, you can dissolve that drop into the ocean, but can you not be that ocean and drop at one and the same time? It separates itself from them by the intensity, largeness, and height of its objective and the specialization of its methods to suit its aim. But it not only starts from them, but for a certain part of the way carries them with it and uses them as auxiliaries. Thus, it is evident how largely ethical thought and practice, not so much external as internal conduct, enter into the preparatory method of yoga, into its aim at purity. Yamas and niyamas. The data of philosophy are the supports from which it begins in the realization of God through the principles of his being. Only It carries the intelligent understanding, which is all philosophy gives, into an intensity which carries it beyond thought into vision, and beyond understanding into realization and possession. What philosophy leaves abstract and remote, it brings into a living nearness and spiritual concreteness. The aesthetic and emotional mind and aesthetic forms are used by yoga as a support for concentration, even in the yoga of knowledge, and are sublimated, the whole means of the yoga of love and delight. As life and action, sublimated are the whole means of the yoga of works. So we see the three paths coming together again, all fused on the experience of identity with that divine in all of its powers. Contemplation of God in nature, contemplation and service of God in man and in the life of man and of the world in its past, present, and future are equally elements of which the yoga of knowledge can make use to complete the realization of God in all things. So ecological, sociological, evolutionarily, this is a world-affirming view, not world-excluding. Only, all is directed to the one aim, directed towards God, filled with the idea of the divine, infinite, universal existence, so that the outward-going, sensuous, pragmatical preoccupation of the lower knowledge with phenomena and forms is replaced by the one divine preoccupation. Again, Katha Upanishad, 4th chapter, 1st verse. After attainment, the same character remains. Sri Aurobindo is writing about himself here. The yogin continues to know and see God in the finite, and be a channel of God consciousness and God action in the world. Therefore, the knowledge of the world and the enlarging and uplifting of all that appertains to life comes within his scope. Only in all he sees God, sees the supreme reality, and his motive of work is to help mankind towards the knowledge of God and the possession of the supreme reality. He sees God through the data of science, God through the conclusions of philosophy, God through the forms of beauty and the forms of good, God in all the activities of life, God in the past of the world and its effects, in the present and its tendencies, in the future and its great progression. Into any or all of these, he can bring his illumined vision and his liberated power of the spirit. The lower knowledge has been the step from which he has risen to the higher. The higher illumines for him the lower and makes it part of itself, even if only its lower fringe and most external radiation. So this search for perfection, for siddhi, the mastery of the nature by the divine conscious force, Aishwarya, this was his personal field of action. As he was writing it down in his record of yoga, based on his Sapta Chatushtaya, the seven quartets. So, his translation of the Katha Upanishad, loosely referred to here, is worth reading. The self-born, Swayambhu, born, in other words, the divine essence, gives itself a form and a manifestation. It brings what is implicit into it, into explicit nature. The self-born has set the doors of the body to face outwards. Therefore, the soul of a man gazes outward and not at the self within. Hardly a wise man here and there, desiring immortality, turns his eyes inwards and sees the self within him. So if you take your gaze away from all the dances in front of you and plunge inside, this you will find waiting for you, your own self. You too are Swayambhu. You too have manifested your own nature. So we'll take up a new chapter next Sunday. If you have patience for Savitri, I thought I would read a passage tonight from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. This is in Canto 10, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind. We'll begin on page 256, towards the bottom. For not by reason was creation made, and not by reason can the truth be seen, which through the veils of thought, the screens of sense, hardly the spirit's vision can descry, dimmed by the imperfection of its means. The little mind is tied to little things. Its sense is but the spirit's outward touch, half waked in a world of darkened conscience. It feels out for its beings and its forms like one left fumbling in the ignorant night. In this small mold of infant mind and sense, desire is a child heart's cry, crying for bliss. Our reason, only a toy's artificer, a rule maker in a strange, stumbling game. But she, her dwarf age, knew, whose confident sight a bounded prospect took for the far goal. The world she has made is an interim report of a traveler towards the half-found truth in things, moving twixt nescience and nescience. For nothing is known while aught remains concealed. The truth is known only when all is seen. Attracted by the all that is the one, she yearns towards a higher light than hers. Hid by her cults and creeds, she has glimpsed God's face. She knows she has but found a form, a robe. But ever she hopes to see him in her heart and feel the body of his reality. As yet, a mask is there and not a brow, although sometimes two hidden eyes appear. Reason cannot tear off that glimmering mask. Her efforts only make it glimmer more. In packets she ties up the indivisible. Finding her hands too small to hold vast truth, she breaks up knowledge into alien parts or peers through cloud rack for a vanished sun. She sees, not understanding what she has seen, through the locked visages of finite things, the myriad aspects of infinity. One day, the face must burn out through the mask. Our ignorance is wisdom's chrysalis. Our error weds new knowledge on its way. Its darkness is a blackened knot of light. Thought dances hand in hand with nescience on the gray road that winds towards the sun. Even while her fingers fumble at the knots which bind them to their strange companionship, into the moments of their marriage strife, sometimes break flashes of the enlightening fire. Even now, great thoughts are here that walk alone. Armed, they have come with the infallible word and an investiture of intuitive light that is a sanction from the eyes of God. Announcers of a distant truth, they flame, arriving from the rim of eternity. A fire shall come out of the infinitudes. A greater gnosis shall regard the world, crossing out of some far omniscience, on lustrous seas from the still rapt alone, to illumine the deep heart of self and things. A timeless knowledge it shall bring to mind, its aim to life, to ignorance its close. Om Tatastu. Om Namaste, Jai Ma.